Immensely rich, the art dealer Joseph Devine was offering to build a new gallery to house perhaps the greatest treasure in the British Museum, the Elgin or Parthenon marbles. Like most Greek and Roman statues, these were once painted, but Devine in the late 1930s wanted them sparkling white. So in what's now considered one of the great art scandals of the time, the museum scoured the Elgin marbles of any last traces of paint. Well, there's no more of that. For some time now, museums and scholars have been reimagining how classical statues once looked in full colour. It's challenging our understanding of how the ancient world actually looked. Far less austere, more human, even at times playful. To discuss, we're invited back to the show Mark Bradley, Professor of Classics at the University of Nottingham, who last year came on to solve the riddle of the lost noses on classical statues. Mark is also an expert on the colour of ancient sculpture. Mark, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, David. Nice to be here.
Look, it's been known for ages that classical statues were painted. Why is it so hard for us to grasp that, to imagine them as coloured?
This is the key question, really. So I think we've inherited classical antiquity in black and white, but the ancient world experienced it in kind of full garish technicolour, and the shock isn't a shock that faced the ancients. It's a shock for the modern world. Since the 18th century, we've developed an aesthetic of, as you say, gleaming white, pure classical marbles. But, we've known for a long time now that they just weren't like this originally.
And it was not just classical statue, was it? I mean, Gothic sculpture was painted. The fronts of cathedrals looked like carnivals.
They did. And I mean, this is, you see reconstructions of medieval cathedral facades, and the garish colours are quite unlike anything that we'd experience today. So, it's like since the early modern period was this big conspiracy to eradicate colour from sculptures that we admire most.
But I find it impossible to believe that the facade of a Gothic cathedral would be repainted.
I suppose you'd imagine that this repainting had to be done on multiple occasions. You have pigment facing bright sunlight. It would probably last about 5 years before it faded. So, actually, when these things were repainted, you could imagine they might be repainted in different ways for different reasons.
But now look, the question is, how accurately can we know what a statue looked like? I mean, they are, to all intents and purposes, white. How much paint is there? Can you be confident that the paint that's there is a top coat or an undercoat?
We've known there are pigment traces for at least 200 years, 250 years or so. And, originally, we used the kind of naked eye and microscopes to try and detect what was there. I mean, what has changed is the science that allows us to access pigment traces and other traces of residue. So, modern science now reveals invisible traces. UV fluorescence, infrared, raking light, and also kind of pigment databases and pigment analysis allows us to uncover what's still there, not just, what's visible to the naked eye. I think the point is, even when colour has gone, then ghosts of the pigment remain, and our technology is getting better and better. But we are in a race against time to record traces of colour before they vanish completely.
There is, however, no one's dug up a statue in Herculaneum or somewhere which is still perfectly painted, have they? There's no surviving statue from the time to show not just the colour, but how the paint was applied.
I mean, there's nothing that survives that's perfectly painted. This is true. And different different chemicals that compose the original colour decompose at different rates. And, you know, some of the boldest colours, so Egyptian blue, cinnabar, do actually, they are durable. They are the bits that hang on. But the, you know, the subtle oils and varnishes that were applied to the surfaces and then other colourants that make the colour very sort of vivid and also very realistic, those tend to decompose. But interestingly, you should mention Herculaneum because, you know, one example really struck me was 2006, archaeologists dug up the head and parts of the body of a giant Amazon, so an Amazonian warrior. And as soon as they dug it up, you know, the pigments that remained in the hair, in the eyes, on the lips, were really quite striking. The bits that sort of stood out the most. And what's really interesting is these are manly kind of warrior women from the ancient world, but this statue head had makeup. It had kind of big long eyelashes. It had kind of lipstick that really sort of stood out, which, you know, completely transforms the way you think about the representation of these ancient mythical warriors.
Indeed, it sounds quite cheap.
It does, and I think this is one thing that always strikes visitors to museums where they've reconstructed coloured statues is just how, you know, how disappointing they look, how they shatter our image of a kind of gleaming white classical past. I mean, one of the best known examples is the statue of Augustus, the first emperor of Rome, from Prima Porta, which now stands kind of as a sort of gleaming beacon of classical art in the Vatican Museum. It's the kind of iconic image of Roman imperial power. It's Augustus in full military garb addressing his army, and he's got a little Cupid at his foot, so that's a kind of mythical god to whom Augustus claimed to be related. But this is probably the most powerful image of Roman imperial power, and this was discovered fairly recently, middle of the 19th century, and has still quite a lot of pigment preserved. So what we've done now is we've reconstructed it with fairly kind of clear accuracy, and this statue has bright red lips. It's got bright red hair. It's got garish reds and blues and shades of purple all over it. And it's just, you know, it hits you like a brick wall. It's like a visit to Madame Tussauds, but a kind of, you know, a Madame Tussauds statue done really badly. And nobody likes it. But this is absolutely much closer to what it looked like than the kind of white statue that we're used to.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Mark Bradley about the true colour of classical statues. But, Mark, it looks ghastly. I mean, the Augustus of Prima Porta looks ghastly. And I have read arguments that suggest that the application of the paint in those sort of bold, flat, reds and blues and things is a misunderstanding of how statues were painted, and that if we look to wall paintings that survive in Herculaneum and Pompeii and other places, it does suggest that the painting on the statues was more subtle.
And I think this is, you know, I think this is absolutely a key point. So, I mean, what the scientists did with the statue of Augustus is they just reconstructed the pigments that were surviving. They stepped away from any efforts to use art historical imagination to do this. So what you see is just what survives. You don't see the much more subtle colorations that might have been created on the statue by processes like ganosis, the application of kind of colored varnishes and oils that would have toned down and made more subtle the pigments that were available. And certainly you're right about the Pompeian wall paintings. Is actually, you know, one thing when I started doing this research, I was told to do was look for evidence of painted statues on Pompeian wall paintings.
All right.
And it's really quite hard because actually, it's sometimes quite hard to tell whether you're looking at a painting of a real person or a god or a goddess or a painting of a statue. So there's this sense of, you know, trompe l'oeil, trick of the eye, yes, when you're looking at these things.
What? Yes. What are you looking at? There's I'm sure you know it. There's a mosaic of a boxer found at a place, Villa San Marco in Stabiae. We assume that this is a statue, and the thing that is beautiful about it is that the statue of the boxer has a bit of sunburn on his shoulders, but his thighs are pale, and the sort of gradation of colour is so unlike the slap-bang effect of the statue of Augustus. It looks natural.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the only thing that, you know, the thing that most gets you thinking that we might be looking at an image of a statue is that boxer standing on a pedestal, right? And that's the bit that kind of toys with the idea that you're looking at a statue. But this is a boxer who looks almost ready to jump off the pedestal. So, you know, and this is actually a representation of a mortal. So I think that the sense is actually with a mortal, you're looking at something that is, you know, is lifelike, is realistic. Once you start looking at a god or a, you know, a divine figure like Augustus, might start to use colours in ways that make them supernatural, not just kind of larger than life, but brighter than life, making you think, actually, this looks like it could be a real person staring back at me, but there are clues, there are tricks in the colour that make you think you're looking at something that is supernatural.
Yes, divine.
So I think
human.
That's partly what's going on with Augustus. He is, you know, he's larger than a real mortal figure. The statue probably produced in AD 15 after Augustus died and after he was deified, turned into a god. So, you know, he's standing on that boundary between mortal and immortal. And I think colour helps you to sort of play around with that idea.
Painted sculpture that does survive, ancient painted sculpture from Egypt, is that a guide to what sculpture more generally might have looked, painted sculpture might generally have looked like? I mean, the head of Nefertiti is painted.
I think that's right. And I think with Egypt, I mean, one thing you have with Egypt is you've got kind of burial and preservation conditions which help pigment to survive better than a lot of Greek and Roman statuary. You perhaps got a little bit more. I mean, one thing when we look at painted classical marbles is they make us think they look a bit Egyptian because we're so used to colour on Egyptian sculpture.
Yes.
But I think, yeah, that's absolutely right. And I think, you know, it's, you know, Egyptian, painted Egyptian stone that's used for sculpture is the type of stone that is more likely to absorb and preserve the pigment than, you know, some of the, some of the Italian and Greek marbles that were painted for Greek and Roman sculpture.
But Mark, I suppose it is impossible to take the next step of repainting actual classical statues in museums.
I think yes. I mean, ideally, this is what we could get a copy of one of these statues, use the original stone, use a really, really good modern sculptor, and then get a really good kind of painter, a good artist to reconstruct with as much kind of imagination as possible what these things might have looked like. That's the ideal scenario. But yeah, we can't. What we can't do is we can't get the original and
splash paint back on it. But isn't one of the problems with the plaster casts being painted is that paint on plaster and paint on marble has a completely different effect. On plaster, it's as flat as a tack. On marble, it sinks into the stone and you get the grain of the stone coming through the colour, completely different.
Absolutely. So, you know, I mean, marble isn't replaced by paint in the way that a plaster surface is replaced by paint. Marble is enhanced by it. So, you know, the translucency of marble, like Parian marble that the statue of Augustus was made of, meant that when it interacted with pigments like cinnabar, the pigments penetrate the crystals of the marble. They give it depth. They make it glow. They work with the marble almost like light under skin.
A last point. Would you agree with me that the Duveen Gallery in which the Parthenon marbles stand is a horrible room?
It was probably just what it needed to be when the marbles were first installed in there. But I think now our aesthetic of classical antiquity and perhaps the diversity of our understanding of what it might have been like, and the idea that it's more tangible now to us than it would have been 200 years ago, mean it just isn't, you know, it doesn't feel like the right place. But the Elgin marbles are almost, you know, a testament to, you know, to what it's like at the start of a 19th century. Their history is now wrapped up in Lord Elgin, in that kind of original projection of what antiquity looked like. So it's really hard to, you know, we're really conservative about moving things around.
Sure.
And as soon as we start moving things around, then of course, you know, there'll be, you know, the arguments about returning them to Greece will be resurfaced.
Oh, yes. But look, if you've got the marbles, you don't need that gloomy grand room. But look, that's perhaps irrelevant to our subject today. Mark, look, thank you for joining us once again on the show. I intend bringing a number of archaeological puzzles to you, and I hope that you will be available for our listeners.
Absolutely. No, I'd love to do this. This is fascinating areas.
These are important questions, and you can answer them. Mark, thank you so much for being on the show. I have been speaking once again to Mark Bradley, Professor of Classics at the University of Nottingham.